Little Emily biting her sister, or is teenage Barry refusing to help around the house? Consulting psychologist David Carey joins us to answer all your parenting woes. It is time for our parenting slot. David Carey joins us once again. Good afternoon to you, David.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Now, what do I do if my 11-year-old boy is terrified of being murdered? He's completely convinced that this is going to happen in his home, mostly in the dark. This has escalated recently, and it's really getting him down. It started with the story of Madeleine McCann, where he was terrified of being abducted, but with all the news recently with shootings, etc., he's convinced bad people are going to come to his home and kill him. Nothing can convince him otherwise, and now I'm wondering whether we should bring him to talk to someone. It's like a phobia.
Yeah, you should bring him to talk to someone. This is anxiety and it's getting out of control. It's escalating. I'm wondering if it's interfering with his sleep, if it's interfering with his ability to separate from parents, to be in a different room with them, etc. So you want to nip this in the bud. Anxiety is fairly easy to treat. It can be directly addressed through some very interesting interventions using art and relaxation and a little bit of fun. So children really enjoy it. That's the most important thing. I would urge this parent to get a referral or just ring up someone who can has experience dealing with children with anxiety difficulties, because it's unlikely just to go away on its own. It's an unusual fear, isn't it, Sean? We haven't had this one before.
Well, I mean, I suppose we have had questions from people who are worried about their kids being exposed, especially there was a period there of 6 weeks or so where there was, you know, twice a week there was some horrific event being reported.
I think we had a question about that last week. Now, here's a little boy that seems to have been triggered with the Madeleine McCann, the story that will never go away, it seems. And it's interesting. Some children are very vulnerable. They're a bit fragile. And when something comes into their consciousness, it's enough to really start anxiety difficulties and worrying to simmer, simmer, simmer. Something simmers long enough, sooner or later it comes to the boil. And so I really think that this boy can be helped very quickly, very easily with some cognitive behavior therapy, some relaxation therapy, combined with a little bit of art therapy. It should all go away pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But to ignore it is to risk that it will just get worse and worse. The problem with anxiety like this, too, is that not only does it get worse and worse, but it expands. It's like an amoeba. It just begins to spread out in all directions and absorb other things as well. Mm. So it can easily transform into phobia about being out of the house, fears of being hurt or lost from separated from parents whilst out shopping or something. And so you really want to address it early on. The earlier we attack the anxiety, the easier it is to treat and the quicker it goes away.
Yeah.
So the prognosis is always very good when you catch it early.
Does it go away permanently? By which I mean, are there some people more inclined towards anxiety anyway?
Yes, there's a strong genetic component. If there's been a parent that has a genuine anxiety disorder of some kind, that includes phobias, all the children born to that parent are at 100% greater risk of developing an anxiety difficulty. That doesn't mean they will, but the risk factor is higher. So anxiety disorders like mood disorders are about 80% heritable, interestingly, strong genetic component. So, and then you have other factors too. It's always interesting to look at birth trauma and neonatal issues, etc., because those are what we call predictive factors as opposed to protective factors. When we're trying to assess in our own minds through an interview with parents and children or adults, we're trying to look at both kinds of context here. Are there predictive factors that are existing in the long history of the individual, such as trauma at birth, difficult delivery, difficulty in the perinatal period, difficulty in the neonatal period, family circumstances, et cetera, genetic influences. And then we try to look for protective factors as well. What are protective factors? Well, one of the biggest protective factors, believe it or not, is general level of intelligence, IQ. If your intelligence is in the average range and above, you're generally much more protected from mental health problems. But there are a host of other things, not the least of which is environment. Are you living in a predictable, secure, and safe environment, or are you living in chaos, or even worse, dysfunction, violence, and aggression. So we look at both things, and you can kind of put them together to see where the antecedents may be, where the triggers may be, and you tailor make a treatment plan accordingly. But I just want to emphasize for all the parents out there with children who are experiencing extreme degrees of anxiety, nervousness, worry, etc., intervene early on. It's well worth it. 4 to 6 visits usually makes a huge difference for most children. If you ignore it, maybe it will go away. Maybe. I can't say for sure. But if it doesn't, it's bound to get worse.
My little boy will be 4 in November and he's starting his free early childhood care and education year next month. He has already attended the creche 4 afternoons a week for the past year. He has a specific language impairment and his receptive language is particularly weak. He has attended speech therapy and his speech has improved a lot, although his language skills are still behind. He tends to play by himself but is happy in his own little bubble. His concentration skills are very weak, even for his age. My concern is that next September he won't be ready for primary school and that in a class of 30-odd kids, he will be lost. If I hold him back another year, he will be nearly 6 starting school. Will he be too old? What will he gain from another year in preschool? I know a lot can change in the next year, but I still have my concerns and I don't want to mess this up.
Well, no parent wants to mess things up. Now, this is a little boy with a specific speech and language disability. It's been assessed. It's been recognized. There is nothing to be harmed by introducing him to school at age 6. In other words, waiting a year. Absolutely no harm. There's more risk of difficulty if we introduce him next September and he integrates into a class of 30 or 32 and his speech and language disability hasn't improved any. So what's the number one thing that he needs? Of course, speech and language therapy on a continued basis under the guidance of a fully qualified speech and language therapist who can set out a treatment program for him. If that happens, the prognosis becomes better and better for a proper adjustment to school. He doesn't need to be in school at age 5. Children don't need to be in school at age 4. 6 is fine. And particular because we have far too many very large infant classroom sizes. You know, 30, 32 infants in a classroom is too much. And it's bound, absolutely a guarantee, that 3 or 4 of them will have some kind of learning difficulty or just developmental delays and developmental issues in terms of readiness, so they'll have problems adjusting. There isn't enough free playtime in most of our kindergarten classrooms, our infant classrooms, and so that's another problem. So for a little boy like this, were I the parent, I would say, let's wait a year. Now, what can be gained by another year of preschool? More opportunity to learn to play with others, because parent is saying he plays mostly by himself. I'd want the preschool to target that. Now, if he's completely comfortable and happy, as she says, in his own little bubble, that's fine. But it mightn't be the best place to stay for the rest of your life. So he probably needs to learn some play skills. Now, preschool is the best place of all to learn them because there's ample opportunity to learn play. And what are we talking about with play skills? Things like sharing play resources, waiting your turn, delaying your gratification, controlling your impulses, coping with frustration, communicating what your needs are, joining in other games and learning how to do that. That's a tricky skill.
Yeah.
And you can observe lots of little children who simply don't know how to ask to join in a game. And what do? They rush in, grab the ball, and want to play, and they disrupt the play that's already ongoing and it causes problems, and they're rejected. Other children don't want them to do that. So there's a lot of skills this little fellow needs to learn, and I'm fairly confident with a focused, very brief written intervention plan at preschool level, and by that I mean a one-page bullet point, Albert Reynolds kind of job, just put down the targets and what you're going to do for him to help increase play skills, to help facilitate the development of receptive and expressive language, and all will be set in place and he'll be well ready and prepared to enter junior infant class at age 6.
Right. We do have to take our commercial break. after that, because oftentimes a lot of the questions we get are, you know, we kind of get versions of the same question over and over again for the very obvious reason that, that similar issues tend to crop up. No one's ever asked this question before, so congratulations to them. The question is, can babies see ghosts? Back in a minute. David Carey still with us for our parenting slot. Next question is this. Can babies see ghosts? My baby niece keeps intermittently smiling and pointing at the ceiling when being put to bed in our darkened room as if someone is entertaining her, but there's nothing there. Is she seeing something?
Well, I don't know if babies can see ghosts. Who does know such a thing?
Yeah.
We might want to believe it. More likely than not, she's engaging in some baby think of some kind. There's something going on in her conscious mind that, of course, she cannot articulate because she's an infant. And it's amusing her, and she's smiling and laughing, and that's a very good thing. And so I don't really know what's going on here. We were talking off air there, and you were saying your little baby does the same thing.
Exactly.
So.
She laughs like a drain, and she's looking at the ceiling, and you don't know what she's laughing about.
And even when you're not being funny.
Even when I'm not being funny, which is most of the time.
Well, of course.
But like we've been out in public places, and she's laughing. And there is that, it being Ireland, people say, is her granddad visiting her? You know, or because it looks like she's looking at someone, because it's the exact same reaction she'd give if you were tickling her or something.
Yes, exactly. And what are they looking at? What are they seeing? We don't really know, unfortunately. And I suppose some neuroscientists may speculate that it's the growth of neurons in the occipital lobe of the brain, which is causing some kind of a phenomenon of vision and light. If you hit your head and you see stars, well, that's because you've actually injured the back of your brain there, the occipital lobe, and that causes these little scintillations in the eyes. So maybe it's some kind of neuronal little development. Who knows, really? Is it ghosts? Well, this comes down to personal belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly can't respond to that. This is beyond the realm of psychology. This strays into the field of what's called parapsychology. And you can get all kinds of answers about these things.
So, if you got that question, who are you going to call?
Boo.
Tish boo. We've been down all week. All right. We'll move on to the next question. I'm having work done in my house at the moment. While the builder was working away, my 3-year-old, almost 4-year-old, was watching him work. When he finished, he asked her what she would like. Would she like to go back to his house and play with his little girl and her toys? To which my daughter said, yes. This has opened my eyes that we need to teach our little ones about strangers. But I'm not sure what's the best way to explain this to her without completely scaring her. Any tips?
Yeah, you explain very simply without the scare factor. You don't introduce any element of danger or that people might harm you or do bad things to you or that people can be bad, etc. You simply say, the only people who can ask you if you want to go back to their house are mommy and daddy, auntie and uncle, nana and granddad, you know, the immediate and extended family. And you just leave it there. You don't have to keep harping on it over and over because it really is too easy to introduce fear in little children by overemphasizing this thing we call stranger danger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a very odd thing here, though, that this builder would ask a nearly 4-year-old child, apart from the parents, to go over to his house. I think there needs to be follow-up to this.
Yeah.
Now, you can't always take the child's
word. Context and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
she may have been yakking away to him the way toddlers can, and he's probably just saying, I have a little girl the same age, you must come over and...
Well, I'd want to find out, though.
Yeah.
That's the least you need to do.
Yeah.
But in terms of introducing it, no, don't introduce the danger element, don't instill the fear element. It's stick to the facts and the practicals. What do children need to know? Well, it's not really a great idea to talk to people you don't know if you're a little child. Certainly, you don't ever accept an invitation to someone you don't know to go with them, to go near their car or in their home. You go right to mommy and daddy or whoever your caregiver is at the time, and you explain to them what's just happened. And the rule is we don't accept invitations from anybody we don't know, just our family, honey.
Yeah.
And I think you only have to say that a couple of times. Children are bright enough to catch on to that.
My 4-year-old daughter has uncontrollable tantrums every day. I brought her to play therapy and they said there's no issue, but it's continuing and upsetting her entire home. She's a middle child and has suffered ill health and hospitalizations. Any ideas?
Well, this is interesting now because we were just talking about predictive factors, weren't we?
Yeah.
So this is a young child who's 4 who has suffered ill health, we don't know what that means, and hospitalizations. So that must mean fairly significant ill health. Now, children who have, at this age of 4, had repeated hospitalizations, and we don't know what sort of procedures may have been performed. Some of them could be intrusive, including IVs and bloods being drawn, or perhaps even more intrusive, I don't know, can be very vulnerable as a result of that, because that is a really scary thing to happen to a child. And if it happens over and over, children can get very distressed by this, and their coping resources can fail them. And that's probably what's happening. This is a 4-year-old with uncontrollable tantrums. I'd like to know more about this, by the way, every day. How uncontrollable? How long do they last? Are there any observable triggers, or do they appear to happen for no reason whatsoever? A lot of what parents call uncontrollable tantrums really result from frustration, not getting what you want, and then throwing a colossal hissy fit to try to get it. And what most parents do, of course, very rightly, is walk away and don't pay attention to the tantrum. However, when we're talking about uncontrollable tantrums, that raises the ante a little bit. I need to know more in order to know what to say. Obviously, again, we have these predictive factors in here. So maybe a child with a little bit of neurobiological irritability, inability to cope, catastrophic reactions to frustration instead of frustration reactions to frustration. And tantrums that go on for an hour or more are far too long to be considered normal tantrums at age 4.
Yeah.
When they go on extreme like that, it needs further investigation.
My son's father decided that the access, as recommended by a court-appointed assessor, wasn't worth it and withdrew and has not had access for 2 years, as is his choice. He's already decided to move to the UK and has married another woman. I don't know where to begin to explain this to our son, as he's now asking questions.
Well, I don't know what kind of questions he's asking, so the questions need to be answered very specifically, according to what the child is asking. Where's daddy? Your daddy is now living in England and he has a new wife and we won't be seeing him anymore probably. And that could be a sufficient answer to the question. Now, if the child...
Would you go that far and say we probably won't be
seeing
him
anymore? Well, maybe not. Yeah. Well, now, he hasn't seen the daddy in 2 years.
No, he hasn't. No. So, people
people sometimes just reappear. And that's a very wrong thing to do, but they do it. So maybe just confine your answer to your daddy lives in England, let's say. And is there another question following that? Because the child may be just asking some very simple, focused questions for information. It's very unfortunate that a father would decide precipitously like that he doesn't need to be involved in the life of the child. We know that the role of the father in the life of a child is extremely important, no less important than the role of the mother. Although our common sense understanding of the role of the mother is to put it in supremacy over the role of the father. But it really is both and, not either or.
Yeah.
And the role of the father has been very thoroughly researched over a lot of years. It serves as a protective factor against all kinds of things, including ill health and delinquency and juvenile offending and failure in school. And a father doesn't have to be heavily involved in the life of the child. Mm. That's what's really interesting. Reasonable involvement is really all that's necessary.
Yeah. Elizabeth says, my son had speech sound delay, born January, held him back, started school at 5 years and 9 months. Best thing I ever did.
Yeah.
Says Elizabeth. Another text says, you say anxiety is very easily treated, but my 7-year-old had severe symptoms last September and again since June. Who do we contact? What do we look up? A therapist. Where are these therapists?
Well, they're all over the place. Most psychologists, particularly psychologists who work with children, can treat this. You can ring up the Psychological Society of Ireland. They will give you names in your area of psychologists registered with them. There are a lot of counselors out there who can also deal with it. Contact your GP.
Yeah.
Because it just won't go away on its own. And there's that texter is telling us that, really, that it just gets worse.
I had a similar text from Desperate Dad. He said, that's exactly my son's experience. 11. He's afraid he might die or even harm himself, get poisoned. This has been going on for 9 months. We tried desperately to get help. HSE took 6 months to give us an appointment with childhood mental health. The service then changed doctors, so we have to start all over again with a new psychologist. Do you have any CBT therapists who you could recommend in Dublin, please? Or is CBT an appropriate place to go
for an
11-year-old?
For an 11-year-old, yes, but usually combine it with some relaxation exercises, some meditation and imagery exercises, some art therapy techniques, and, of course, a little bit of conversation. Mm. So if anyone wants some referral information, they can just send me an email. We can get it through News Talk.
And we can send that on to David, of course. As to whether babies can see ghosts, Des says, I fear the person who asked about ghosts may have watched too many episodes of Quantum Leap. Ziggy says kids only see the truth, Sam, says Des. They're all looking at me going... Yeah, it's a quote from Quantum Leap. They're all looking at me going, what's Quantum Leap?
Well, I'm echoing that. What's Quantum Leap?
Yeah.
Is it a television show?
It is a television show.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No, sorry, I was mistaken. Apparently Claire and Ed love it. They grew up watching it. Most of their worldview is formed by Quantum Leap. My son used to wave at the... This is where... You can never know where a ghost might be. My son used to wave at the ceiling in the old Super Quinn in Nace. Said the man was waving. It was the site of the old police barracks. My niece did the same thing in the same spot when she was young.
You know, interestingly, about 5 years ago, I had a girl of around age 10 came in the office, and her complaint was that she sees dead people. Now, this sounds like something out of a movie. She had an incredibly traumatic experience in her life, unfortunately, witnessing the death of her mother. Under the most tragic sorts of circumstances. But she was absolutely convinced and could describe in great detail, even as we walked down the hall, the physical features of the people she saw in the hallway. Now, it's doubly interesting because she was incredibly functional in every area of her life, except to be mildly depressed and distressed about this. But a lot of that related to the tragedy that had ensued only 3 years before. She was a very good student in school, incredibly well-behaved, popular, had friends. There was no sign of disturbance anywhere in her life except that she saw these dead people all the time. And regrettably, we lost track of her because the family moved away, and that was the end of that. So I don't know the end of the story.
How intriguing. How utterly intriguing.
I could describe to a T how they were dressed, what they looked like, their general age, male or female, facial features.
That's extraordinary. Listen in every Wednesday at 3 p.m. here on Moncrief for more parenting advice from David Carey.